Also want to thank you for the invitation to come and share with you today, this morning and this evening. It's certainly a pleasure for me and a privilege to share God's holy word with God's people here. And I pray for your ministry, for your congregation, for your church, for the search you have for a pastor. Isaiah chapter 21 deals with the Persian Gulf. If it is not the Persian Gulf, there is no other body of water in the Middle East that it could be. This is the burden of the desert of the sea. A small body of water, here called a sea, surrounded by desert. In verse 1, Isaiah writes, "As whirlwinds in the south pass through, so it cometh from the desert." As whirlwinds. What a desert storm. Right here in verse 1. Now those who named the conflict over their desert storm probably did not consult Isaiah before naming it. However, Isaiah knew almost 3,000 years ago, 2,700 years ago, that it was going to be a desert storm. And he wrote, "As whirlwinds in the south pass through, so it cometh from the desert." And indeed, it certainly has. From the south toward the north, from the desert into Iraq. Verse 2, "A grievous vision is declared unto me. The treacherous dealer dealeth treacherously, and the spoiler spoileth." So he has. His name is Saddam Hussein. He is a treacherous dealer. He has spoiled Kuwait. In verse 3, the prophet Isaiah lets us know that the birth pangs of travail are present in this conflict. That makes it an end-time war. You recall Matthew 24, where Jesus told his disciples, nation would rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There would be wars and rumors of wars. There would be disease and famine and earthquakes in diverse places. And he said in verse 8, all these are the beginning of sorrows. That is the birth pangs of travail. And in John's gospel, there is the record of Jesus talking to his disciples, telling them that he must go away, but he'll come back someday. And the disciple says, we don't understand. What do you mean? Well, Jesus said, it's like a woman giving birth to a baby. The birth pangs are listed here by the prophet Isaiah. Therefore my loins are filled with pain. Pangs have taken hold upon me as the pangs of a woman that travaileth. And then he is told to be a watchman, to ascend the watchtower. Verse 6, and let him declare what he seeth. And he saw a chariot with a couple of horsemen. A chariot is an instrument of war. Here is a chariot with a couple of horsemen. I think this refers to a multinational force. And a chariot of asses, the beast of burden that carries the support equipment. There must be the medical supplies, food, ammunition, etc. And then a chariot of camels. Now here are those Arabian forces, I think, that are gathered with this chariot and a couple of horsemen. There are some few from Kuwait, what's left of Kuwait, who park their Mercedes-Benz and get their Nike tennis shoes and go out to war. And then there are those Saudi Arabians. Egypt has also sent forces into the conflict, and Syria, of all nations, joins. He sees a chariot of camels, the Arabian forces, alongside the chariot and a couple of horsemen. And then, verse 8, the watchman cries, "A lion, my Lord." He sees a lion in the desert. Forgive me, but I just happen to believe that the scriptures here are relevant to the day in which we live. And if we were to look around this world for a lion, we would have to park at Great Britain, for the symbol of Great Britain is a lion. Why would Great Britain be interested in Kuwait? Because in 1932, British Petroleum signed an agreement with the Royal Family of Kuwait to poke holes in the sand looking for oil. And they found it in 1936. British Petroleum owned at that time 50% of the oil in Kuwait. And the British government owns 51% of British Petroleum. Why is the lion interested in that part of the desert world? A lion, my lord, he cries. Great Britain is there. Verse 9, and behold, here cometh a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Folks, that's not New York City. That's not Moscow. That's Babylon. Notice, please, the prophet said it twice. Babylon is fallen, number one. Is fallen, number two. Now, the Jewish theologians have a comment for this. Any place in the Old Testament prophets where it mentions something twice. They say that this two renderings of it makes it two fulfillments. A near fulfillment and a far fulfillment. Well, we saw the near fulfillment in the days of Belshazzar, didn't we? When he saw the handwriting on the wall and Babylon fell that night. But there is yet another far fulfillment prophesied in the scriptures. And I believe we have arrived at that far fulfillment. Babylon is fallen, is fallen. You'll see those same words in Revelation chapter 18, speaking of mystery. Babylon the Great. Babylon is fallen, both a near and a far fulfillment. In verse 11, we get to the burden of Duma. Now, this is an area of southern Jordan. This would be what we would call ancient Edom, or the area where Esau and his kids once lived. And when the Edomites were driven out, Obadiah's prophecy predicted it. The Idumeans came in, half Edomite, half Jewish. Well, the Edomites intermarried with some Jewish families in the south, produced a nation called Duma, or Idumea. You recall Herod the Great was an Idumean, half Edomite, half Jew. And so here is a prophecy upon Duma, or southern Jordan, where the city of Petra is located today. And if you've ever been to Jordan, you'll know that there is a highway that runs from Amman, Jordan, down past Petra, all the way to the Gulf of Aqaba. For there is a port there on the Gulf, at Aqaba, a port where military supplies are unloaded continually and are taken up that highway past Amman, either into Syria or into Iraq, and more than likely into Iraq. And we've heard even on the news in recent days how that our State Department suspects that military supplies are still moving up that highway and into Iraq. Is it possible then that soon southern Jordan will be bombed to cut off that supply line to Iraq? The burden of Duma, he calleth unto me out of Seir, that is an ancient name for the city of Petra. Watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? Why would he say such a thing? Why would he ask such a question? Because in the days of Isaiah, armies fought only in the daytime. They were afraid of the night. They had no lights to fight by. They wouldn't know who they were fighting at night. Attacks came at daybreak, and they fought in the day, and they stayed in their tents at night. But here is a conflict that rages mostly in the night. And it's kind of interesting, you know, that this war, more than perhaps any other war in the past, is a war fought primarily at night because we possess the kind of machinery that can see through the dark. And we own the night. Watchmen, what of the night? Do you recall that first night when the fighting started? I was watching it was about 40 minutes after 5 o'clock in the evening on ABC when they were in contact with their people in Baghdad when suddenly the whole sky in Baghdad lit up with the tracer bullets, and our war had begun at night. Watchmen, what of the night? And there on the nightly news, we were watchmen on the wall watching the night. Notice, please, in verse 13, the burden of Arabia. Well, that's where our soldier boys are now, isn't it? The burden upon Arabia. In the forests in Arabia shall ye lodge, O ye traveling companies of Dedanim. Now, the letters I-M on the end of a word is the Hebrew equivalent of the plural. So this is not singular here, but plural. The traveling companies, plural, of Dedan. Dedan was an ancient tribe that settled in the Arabian Peninsula. We are looking here at Saudi Arabia. Do you recall Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 13? It mentions Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with the young lions thereof. Sheba is modern day Kuwait. Sheba is Kuwait. The ruling family of Kuwait have a last name, Al-Sabah, derivative of Sheba. You're looking at the ruling family of Kuwait when you look at Sheba. And Dedan, Saudi Arabia. The forests of Arabia. I didn't know there were any forests in Arabia. That doesn't look much like it on the nightly news, does it? But if you'll check out the royal coat of arms of Saudi Arabia, you will find a palm tree, a date palm. The forest of Arabia. I mean, it's a part of Saudi Arabia's coat of arms, the tree. And under that, the sword of Islam. On the green flag of Saudi Arabia, you will see Arabian lettering. In the Arabian language, across the green flag of Saudi Arabia, it says, Allah alone is God and Muhammad is his only prophet. That's what those Arabic words say on the green flag. But underneath those Arabic words on the green flag is a sword, the sword of Islam, the militancy of Islam. The burden upon Arabia, in the forest of Arabia ye shall lodge, O ye traveling companies of Dedan. Verse 14, the inhabitants of the land of Tema brought water to him that was thirsty. They prevented him with their bread him that fled. Tema is also in southern Jordan. We're looking again at the country of Jordan. And here we have Jordan supplying food for those who escape the war. You remember in August and September, seeing on the nightly news all those people coming across from the Arabian desert, coming out of Kuwait and across Iraq, moving across from Saudi Arabia into Jordan and setting up tent cities. And the king of Jordan said, we don't have enough money or food to feed everybody, to help everybody. And he called upon the other nations of the world to help him, help them. Listen to the reading of the word. The inhabitants of the land of Tema or Jordan brought water to him that was thirsty. They prevented him or supplied him with their bread, him that fled. For they fled from the swords and from the drawn sword. Shall I say the sword of Islam? And from the bent bow and from the grievousness of war. For thus hath the Lord said unto me, within a year, according to the years of an hireling, and all the glory of Kedar shall fail. Kedar is that neck of land east of Amman, Jordan, running up to the border of Iraq. That's where all those tent cities were located when the refugees, some 200,000 of them, came across the border into Jordan. But within a year, says the word of God, the glory of Kedar shall fail. Now, I wonder what that means. Is it possible that Jordan is going to fall to the hands of an enemy? Will Jordan remain intact? Will King Hussein keep his throne? Or will Jordan fail? God says the glory of Kedar shall fail. Now let's look at Jeremiah chapter 50. For two nights ago on CNN News, Rabbi Shlomo Gorin, speaking from Jerusalem, said he was delighted with this war, for it heralds the coming of the Messiah and is a fulfillment of Jeremiah chapter 50. Let's begin with chapter 49. Concerning the Ammonites. Please understand that the capital of Jordan is Amman, Jordan, a derivative of the word Ammon. Concerning the Ammonites, thus saith the Lord, hath Israel no sons? Hath he no heir? Why then doth their king inherit Gad, and his people dwell in his cities? The king of the Ammonites inherits the territory of Gad. God says, has Israel no son? What is the king of the Ammonites doing sitting on Gad's territory? That's what God says. If you'll check out the Old Testament, you'll find that the territory of the tribe of Gad, one of the Israeli tribes, the tribes of Israel, Gad lived on the east side of the Jordan River in what is today called the country of Jordan, including Amman, Jordan. That's the territory of ancient Gad. And the word Gad means a troop, so you can see the conflict of war, even in the meaning of his name. So what's going to happen since the king of the Ammonites sits on Gad's territory? Verse 2, that's Jeremiah 49, verse 2. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will cause an alarm of war to be heard in Rabbah of the Ammonites. Rabbah is a city called today Amman, Jordan. It's the same city. And it shall be a desolate heap. And her daughter shall be burned with fire. Then shall Israel be heir unto them that were his heirs, saith the Lord. Israel is going to inherit Jordan. That's what God says. Do you remember Genesis chapter 15 when God came to Abraham and promised him all the land from the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates? Now, folks, God's promised land to Israel includes Jordan and Syria and Iraq. Maybe Kuwait and Saudi Arabia as well. For God has promised Israel all of the land from the river Euphrates to the great river, or from the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates. Now let's look at chapter 50, beginning in verse 4. And here's what excited Rabbi Shlomo Gorin, who was for several years the head rabbi of Israel. In those days and in that time, so you see there is a specific time set for this event to happen, saith the Lord, the children of Israel shall come, they and the children of Judah together, going and weeping, they shall go and shall seek the Lord their God. And they shall ask the way to Zion with their faces thitherward, saying, come, and let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten. I want to pause here and say that in the days of Jeremiah, there was a division in the land. The northern 10 tribes had pulled away from the southern 2 tribes and had seceded from the Union. There was a conflict between Israel in the north and Judah in the south. But Jeremiah says there will come a day when there will be no more conflict between the 12 tribes, that they will all come hand in hand, joined together. They shall be as one people. And they shall say, let's go home. Let's go home to the promised land. And let's make a perpetual covenant with the Lord. That's a covenant that will last forever. This is one of the great scriptures. Jeremiah records it in chapter 30. He says, I will make a new covenant, says God. I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. A new covenant? Oh, yes. It will be a new covenant, but that new covenant was really given at the end of their 40 years in the wilderness. It can be found in Deuteronomy chapters 29 and 30. That covenant is a covenant of grace. But that covenant given at the end of the 40 years lay dormant, not effective until the death of the testator, the one who made that covenant. He died on Calvary. Hebrews chapter 8 and 9 tell us about that. And quote Jeremiah chapter 30. And here the Jews are saying, it's time for us to make that covenant with God. When God says, I will make a new covenant. That covenant, by the way, that you and I are under and have been under since Calvary. The Jews are not under that covenant. They could be if they would accept it, but they've rejected it and have chosen to stay under the old covenant, the covenant of law. And Israel today is still under that covenant of law. For if you'll check out that Mosaic covenant of law very carefully, you will find it that you'll find out that that covenant bears a curse upon the house of Israel. Under that covenant, God promises to scatter them among the Gentile nations and make them the whipping boy of nations and make them to become the wandering Jew. Under that covenant of law, God promises to kick them out of their land, and he promises to make them say, oh, would to God it was morning, and in the morning they would say, would to God it was nighttime. And all we have to do is look at the Holocaust of World War II to say, yep, the curses of the covenant of law is still being carried out upon Israel. In 1948, Israel began to go home. But do you notice that the Jews don't normally go home unless there are a lot of people who are against them and hate the Jews? You notice they usually are interested in going home when things get too hot for them? It was the pogroms of Tsarist Russia that caused so many hundreds of thousands of Jews to come to America shortly after the turn of the century. And for them to fight against the Tsar in the early 1900s. It was the Holocaust of Europe that made the Jews finally want to regain their promised land, and they were determined to reestablish the nation of Israel and did so in 1948. They went home under persecution. That's one reason, by the way, why Moses was able to lead them out of Egypt. They were slaves in the beautiful, wonderful land of Goshen, where they had risen to prosperity for a time and didn't want to go home. And so it takes the reed upon the back. It takes the beating before God's chosen people want to go home. Why then in Jeremiah 50 do they want to go home? Why do they ask the way to Zion with their faces thitherward, saying, come and let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten? Listen as I read on, and you will find out why the Jews want to go home. My people have been lost sheep. Their shepherds have caused them to go astray. They have turned them away on the mountains. They have gone from mountain to hill. They have forgotten their resting place. All that found them have devoured them. I would say that is true. All we have to do is look at the historical account. All that found them, the Jews, devoured them. And their adversaries said, we offend not, because they have sinned against the Lord, the habitation of justice, even the Lord, the hope of their fathers. Isn't that amazing that Jeremiah pre-recorded the attitude of people in their anti-Semitism? Jew haters today think they're doing God a favor by hating the Jews. Incredible. No wonder they want to go home. They're not welcome in the Soviet Union. 200,000 of them fled the Soviet Union in 1990, in the last 12 months. And their numbers are ever increasing. Pray that the Soviet Union will keep the gates open long enough to let the rest of them go home. The Ethiopian Jews have been rescued and brought back home to the land of their ancient forefathers, the black Jews of Ethiopia, because to this very day, immigration in Israel, to Israel, is flourishing. So much so that they don't have enough houses and apartments to house everybody. Israel is hurting today because of an influx of too many people, too many mouths to feed. Who's going back to Israel today? Intelligent people, brilliant minds. It is said that most of the people who come off of the plains from Russia this last year came with their violins under their arms. Brilliant, talented people. People with degrees in science, technology. In fact, if you'll check back over the recent past, you'll find that most of the inventions that have changed our world today came out of the fertile minds of Jewish people. Einstein was a Jew. And so it has been. That's just by way of example. Notice, please, in verse 7, that the Jews suffer at the hands of the Gentiles. And so they want to go home. Now we come down to this burden upon Babylon written by Jeremiah. Notice, please, in verse 19, he says, I'll bring Israel again to his habitation, and he shall feed on Carmel and Bashan. Oh, Bashan is Syria. And his soul shall be satisfied upon Mount Ephraim and Gilead. Well, Gilead is Jordan. So as we look at the nightly news and watch the war in the Middle East, please, Christian, understand that Iraq is not the main problem right now. Iraq is just a part of the situation that's going on. Watch what Israel is going to do next. That's the one to watch. Watch Israel. Now let's get with this battle of Babylon. Look at verse 29. Call together the archers against Babylon. All ye that bend the bow, camp against it round about. And by the way, they're using the terminology of 3,000-year-old armies simply because they did not have the terminology for our modern vocabulary. They knew nothing back then about missiles and airplanes and modern technology. But I see that modern technology here. Let none thereof escape. Recompense her according to her work, according to all that she hath done. Do unto her, for she hath been proud against the Lord, against the Holy One of Israel. Therefore shall her young men fall in the streets, and all her men of war shall be cut off in that day, saith the Lord. That's what's going to happen to Iraq. Look at verse 41. Behold, a people shall come from the north, and a great nation, and many kings shall be raised up from the coasts of the earth. This is a multinational force here. And they shall hold the bow and the lance. They are cruel and will not show mercy. Their voice shall roar like the sea. They shall ride upon horses, every one put in array, like a man to the battle against thee, O daughter of Babylon. The king of Babylon, Mr. Saddam Hussein, hath heard the report of them, and his hands waxed feeble. Anguish took hold of him, and pangs as of a woman in travail. I heard on the news tonight that Saddam Hussein is under the care of three doctors tonight. He's taking pills to help him cope with the stress of this war. This verse is apropos to this very day and this very night. Wow. Look at chapter 51, verse 30. The mighty men of Babylon have forborne to fight. Does that sound like the Iraqis today? They're afraid to fight. What do they do when their airplanes come up? They head for Iran. That's a good way to describe it. They ran. The mighty men of Babylon have forborne to fight. They have remained in their holes. They stayed in their bunkers. And we have seen that on the nightly news in recent days. Their might hath failed. They became as women. They have burned their dwelling places. Her bars are broken. One post shall run to meet another, and one messenger to meet another, to show the king of Babylon that his city is taken at one end, and that the passages are stopped, and the reeds have they burned with fire, and the men of war are affrighted. There it is. The men of Iraq are afraid. We have been told on the news, forgive me for mentioning the news so much, but to me, I see Jeremiah as if it were the daily newspaper. Those prisoners of war we have taken from Iraq, we are told that when our jets fly over their prison camp, they curl up into a fetal position. They're afraid. Even as prisoners of war, they're still afraid. Will the war last long? Verse 49, by the way, I think gives us the reason for this war. As Babylon hath caused the slain of Israel to fall, so at Babylon shall fall the slain of all the earth. Babylon came and destroyed Solomon's temple, and God has not forgotten it to this very day. Babylon will fall. When Babylon fell under the Medes and the Persians, it did not fall as Sodom and Gomorrah fell. There was no fire from heaven then, but there is today, just as the prophets say. And the city of Babylon continued to fall into disarray, but never did become an uninhabited city, but it will. God promises that it will. If we are to watch Israel then, what is Israel going to do? I believe Saddam Hussein is going to try chemical weapons. I think thousands and tens of thousands of people will die because of those chemical weapons. And Israel will move into action. Perhaps those, I think they were called SU-24s, that fleet of airplanes that the Crown Prince Hassan of Jordan said recently that King Hussein had loaded with chemical weapons ready for Israel. If he tries to move those planes against Israel, by the way, it only takes 6 minutes to go from the border of Iraq and Jordan to Tel Aviv. So Israel will not have but just a matter of a few minutes to move against those planes coming in with chemical warheads and chemical weapons. Perhaps Israel's Air Force will meet them over Jordan, or perhaps Israel's Air Force will meet them over the West Bank. And in that fight, when the planes of Babylon will be shot down by the Israelis, the superior Israelis, perhaps those chemical weapons will rain upon the Palestinians or the Jordanians. Or perhaps Israel will move across the Jordan into Jordanian airspace, and Jordan will have to retaliate and will get into the war whether they want to or not, and suddenly Israel is fighting Jordan. And of course Syria will also have to move against Israel, because even on the news tonight, Israel is calling for a second war front in Lebanon. I knew it 6 months ago, because when we allowed, and our Pentagon allowed Syria to move troops into Beirut and into Lebanon and destroy the Christian forces there, in what for the last 15 years has been a genocide of the Christian community in Lebanon, I knew Israel would not stand for it. Eventually, Israel is going to move to liberate the Christian community in Lebanon. I believe Israel is going to fight in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Jordan, and will take Jordan, and will take Syria. Isaiah chapter 17 says, the burden of Damascus shall become a ruinous heap. When will that happen? I don't know, maybe weeks, maybe months. I don't think it'll be long. I believe Israel will get involved in this war shortly. Restraining so far, but it'll not last long until Israel is in the war fighting against Syria and Jordan and Iraq. And when that happens, Damascus will be destroyed, and Amman, Jordan will be destroyed, and Israel will occupy those territories. Now, we're busy over there in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia with Iraq. And we're going to be sitting on our hands when it comes to our ally, Israel. We're not going to retaliate against Israel. But the world will come against Israel and say, you can't do that. If we condemn Saddam Hussein for annexing Kuwait, then we condemn Israel for annexing Jordan and Syria. That's what the world will say. God says, that's promised land to Israel. The Soviet Union, I believe, will say, you can't do that. And Libya will say, that's right, you tell them. And Iran will say, that's right, you tell them, Gorby. And we'll be sitting on our hands. We'll not want to take the side of Israel, but we'll not want to come militarily against Israel either. Well, we're sending crews and Patriot missiles to Israel to help them. And so the Soviet Union will say to us, if you're not going to take care of Israel, we will. And that brings us then to Ezekiel chapter 38, the battle of Gog and Magog. Notice, please, in verse 5 of Ezekiel 38, when the Soviet Union moves against Israel, there will be certain countries with the Soviet Union. Persia, that is Iran, Ethiopia, Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer, which for the recent past has been translated and interpreted by many Bible scholars as Germany. And now we have Germany reunited. Will Germany be with the Soviet Union? I don't know. As far as I know, they will. The Warsaw Pact nations, I believe, are considered here as we look at Gomer and Togarma. But please notice who is not listed. Syria is not listed. Lebanon is not listed. Jordan is not listed. That is, the ancient tribes of Edom, Moab, and Ammon are not listed. Kedar is not listed. Egypt also is not listed as against Israel. But we can see the nations that are with Russia. Babylon is not listed, which I think means that the war in the Middle East now is a prelude, getting things in ready, in the right situation for this battle of Gog and Magog. Notice, please, what we're going to be doing about it. Verse 13, Sheba and Dedan, that's Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, the merchants of Tarshish, that's the European merchants, the British in particular, with all the young lions, that's the colonies of Great Britain, namely the United States and the other allies that are there, in the Persian Gulf area. As the Soviet Union gathers their forces with Iran and moves down across the northern part of Iraq towards Syria, we're going to ask them, are you coming in this direction? Art thou come to take a spoil? Are you coming after this oil? But Russia will be moving against Israel. Notice verse 9. Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. So you see, Desert Storm isn't over yet, is it? As the Soviet Union gets into the picture, thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land. Notice, backing up a verse, after many days thou shalt be visited. In the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword. Could that be the sword of Islam? The sword on the flag of Saudi Arabia? But you know, Russia is going to fall on the mountains of northern Israel. Why? Verse 21. God says, I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith the Lord. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. And there's the key to the defeat of the Soviet Union. We see the Soviet Union today, a divided country, nigh unto civil war. And the reason why the mighty Soviet Union's forces will fall against Israel is because they hate each other and they're too busy fighting each other to fight Israel. And God is in this. It is the Lord's judgment upon the North country. That's what we can expect in the days ahead. I believe when Israel takes Jordan and Syria, the Soviet Union has a 20-year defense treaty with Syria to come to their aid in case of an attack. The Soviet Union will have no choice but to move against Israel when Israel defeats Syria. Israel will also take back the Temple Mount and will set up a temporary tent for temple liturgy. They will restore temple worship on the Temple Mount before the Soviet Union comes. We were reading from Ezekiel 38. If you back up three verses in chapter 37 of Ezekiel, you'll find out that God says, I will set my sanctuary in the midst of them. My tabernacle also shall be with them. I believe the Jewish people are going to go up on that Temple Mount soon. And you know, of course, the 21 who died in the Temple Mount massacre last October was over the same question, the same problem. Israel wants on the mountain. They're tired of being down at the foot of the mountain at the Western Wall. They want to worship God in the courtyards of the Lord. And when Israel sets up temple worship, it will prepare them for the International Peace Conference, wherein someone whom I believe will be in European politics will rise to the forefront to make an enforced peace treaty upon Israel and the Arabs. He will confirm the covenant with many. He is Mr. Wonderful. He is Mr. 666. I think we're that close, folks. And when Europe enforces this peace against Israel, they will make Jerusalem an international city and will allow Jewish worship on that mountain, but only on the northern half of that mountain. And the southern half of the Temple Mount will remain with the Mosque of Omar and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the Antichrist will come in the midst of the tribulation period to commit the abomination of desolation. And the whole world will rise up against Israel and try for one more genocide of the Jewish race. That's Armageddon. But in the midst of it all, a beleaguered Jewish people who have no friends in that day, and the whole world will be against them, and those who come against Israel will think they're doing God a favor. The beleaguered Jewish people, having no place else to turn, knowing that soon every Jew on the earth will die, and that their cries to God have been like heavens of brass, they will turn to the One their forefathers nailed to a cross. And when he, Jesus, hears them say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord, Jesus will say to those of the heavenly host, Come on, fellas, it's time to go home. And the sun will turn as black as sackcloth of ashes, and the moon will turn as blood, and in the darkened sky over Jerusalem there will appear in the heavens a light of exquisite beauty, magnificent in its majesty, and every eye shall see him. And every knee shall bow, and every tongue shall confess that Jesus is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. He's coming soon, and he will establish the seventh millennium of human history, 1,000 years of peace, real, real peace. Hallelujah. I'm glad I know Jesus is my Psalm 19:91. Not the Jews. Oh no, this is 5751 in their calendar. And if they refer to 1991, they call it CE. 1991 in the common era. They revere Bar Kochba, who was declared the Messiah by the high priest of Israel, who fell in battle against Hadrian and the Romans and caused the scattering of the Jews to the slave markets of the world in 135 AD. And yet they revere that man who caused their dispersion, and they hate Jesus. What did Jesus do that bad to them? I want you to know that the Jewish people don't understand us. Unfortunately, many Christians don't understand the Jews. We don't understand how this is working in God's economy. This Old Testament and New Testament, this Old Covenant and New Covenant, and we get our ideas about what God's going to do, but I just want you to know that when it all comes down to the finality, it is God who knows what He's doing, and it is we who submit to the will of God. Love the Jew. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Bless Israel. For one day soon, we will walk with them down streets of gold. For God plans the salvation of Israel. God is planning for the salvation of Israel. Then let us be on God's side. Between now and the rapture, win as many people as you can. We have so little time. We must do all we can while we can, for night cometh when no man can work. My challenge to you, dear Christian, is to win as many people as you can, for that's all that counts between now and the rapture. For we have arrived soon. We don't know exactly when. We're going to hear a shout and a trumpet sound, and we will be gone. So while you can, win as many people as you can. If you're here tonight without the Lord Jesus Christ as your Savior, I ask you to receive Christ. He alone can save you. And He will. He wants to. If you'll ask Him. Would you bow your heads in prayer, please?